this will be slavery what you've never been told. I'm pretty convinced that most of what you'll get in this presentation, you've probably never heard from any school textbook or any film or documentary, but it's very factual and documented. But let's start off with A Tale of Two Islands. You've heard of The Tale of Two Cities? Well, this is The Tale of Two Islands. You would have noticed that recently the American president visited Africa. In fact, it was the most expensive presidential visit ever. $100 million. That's American dollars, not Zimbabwe dollars. Described as the most expensive presidential tour ever. He visited Gori Island. One of the first things he did was visiting Gori Island, across the bay from Dakar, the capital of Senegal. There he is photographed at the slave fort's famous door of no return. Now, Baum was quoted as saying, "This is a testament to what, to when we are not vigilant in defense of human rights, what can happen." Now, he drew attention to the slave trade that was outlawed over 200 years ago. A disgraceful slave trade. But it did end 200 years ago. The slave trade from West Africa through to the Americas. And it was particularly between the 1600s and the 1860s that the slave trade took place. But he was silent on the much larger, much longer Arab slave trade that still plagues Africa. This book, Slave, My True Story, was published in 2003. It's very up to date. This girl, a Nuba girl, Mende Nazir, was enslaved as a teenager in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan. She was first enslaved in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. Then later, her master went to work as a diplomat in the Sydney's embassy in London. And he had the audacity to take the slaves with him. Well, she knew that slavery is illegal in England. So she escaped, sought political asylum, managed to get a book published, Slave, My True Story. Just documentation of how blatant, and to think that they have the audacity to take the slaves even to Western countries in the embassy. But the anti-slavery societies today calculate that there are over 27 million people who are victims of slavery today. Some would say it's even more. According to UNICEF, 1.2 million children are trafficked each year, and most trafficking victims are girls between 5 and 15 years of age. So that's the sex slavery trafficking, human trafficking, which is modern day slavery. And if you add that to the stats, it's even more. And if you want a really honest, accurate picture of human trafficking today, the film The Whistleblower is extraordinary in that it is so honest, and it is not one of these, this is based on a true story. This is a true story. This is actually very accurate to the case of an American policewoman who was sent to Bosnia and who discovered that the UN themselves were running the human trafficking, and she went right up the top, up to the General Secretary, and she had death threats, and she lost her job, and she had to flee, and she was vindicated in a London court of law on all of her accusations that the UN was involved in slave trafficking. She's now living under police protection in Britain, too scared to go back to her home country of America, because she blew the whistle on the UN's involvement in human trafficking today.
Yeah.
Absolute scandal beyond imagining, but well documented. Many of the governments that today enjoy most favored nation status with the United States of America are involved in the modern day slave trade. In fact, Mauritania, which notice is right next to Senegal, there's the car, Gori Island's just off there, here's Mauritania. Mauritania's got over 500,000 slaves in a country of only 3 million people. That means 1 out of 6 Mauritanians is a slave. Samuel Cotton, an African-American author of Silent Terror, A Journey into Contemporary African Slavery, reports that Mauritanian Arabs and Berbers bring their black slaves with them to work in Dakar, even within sight of Gori Island. So actually, we're not talking about something that ended 200 years ago at all. Yet Obama had not one word to say about this ongoing scandal. For foreign consumption and under external pressure, Mauritania has made some half-hearted legislative attempts to outlaw slavery, but these have been described as woefully ineffective and blatantly insincere. For example, 2011, four Mauritanian anti-slavery activists were sentenced to 6 months in jail for protesting the enslavement of a 10-year-old girl. So how serious are they in fighting slavery when they lock up people who expose it? No punishment was ever meted out to the slave owner, and the slave girl disappeared. President Obama hypocritically stated that his visit to Gori Island, which is a World Heritage Site, gives me even greater motivation in terms of human rights around the world. But he didn't have anything to say about Mauritania, which is almost within sight of this. Africans find his statement hard to take seriously, considering Obama's not said a word about the ongoing 1,400-year Arab involvement in the slave trade. Although Obama made a major point of visiting Gori Island and condemning the transatlantic slave trade, which ended 2 centuries ago, he showed no interest in visiting Zanzibar, the most notorious slave island in history on the east coast of Africa. Because slavery has been going on all over. It's not just Gori Island of Senegal. Zanzibar was very, very busy too. Now, although Obama's second state visit in Africa was Tanzania, he never ventured near the island of Zanzibar, which processed 20,000 African slaves every year. By the way, can I show you what a photo op is? Notice the journalists. Notice how they're crouching down. Why are they crouching down? To get the impression that the American president is walking through a crowd of people in Tanzania, shaking hands, man of the people, not afraid of the people, not surrounded by bodyguards and so on. He's just... But notice. Notice the red carpet. Notice the US Security Service on both sides, and the crowd is only 3 or 4 deep. Notice how everyone in the crowd is wearing the same color hat. In fact, it's exactly the same hat. Notice how they all have conveniently Tanzanian and American flags. You take a Tanzanian flag, you take an American flag. And so, these people are screened. These people are selected. This is rent-a-crowd. This is a photo op. This is a stage-managed op. So, from the perspective of the journalists crouched down here, you're giving an impression of a bomb amongst a crowd of hundreds of spontaneously enthusiastic Africans welcoming you. But in fact, these people, notice how these bodyguards all peering over the shoulders, they've got to crouch, otherwise they'll get the US Secret Service ones looking over the shoulders of these rent-a-crowd. And this is how a picture is set up. But those are the pictures that were published. I think I've seen examples like this before, but this is one of the more blatant I've come across. Now, perhaps Obama was concerned not to embarrass his Muslim friends, who's still involved in the slave trade today. I mean, if he went to Zanzibar Island, that could really embarrass the Arabs. Also, a visit to Stone Town on Zanzibar would have been far more embarrassing, as the former slaves, after being liberated by the British Royal Navy, built a magnificent church, a cathedral actually, over the old slave market, with a pulpit and altar by where the auction block and the whipping post had stood. The Anglican cathedral called Christ Church in Mukunazini Road is the centre of Old Town. It occupies the area where the largest slave market in Zanzibar used to be situated. The construction of the cathedral was intended to celebrate the end of the Arab slave trade on Zanzibar. And the altar and pulpit were designed to be in the exact place where the main whipping post and slave auction block had been. And construction of Christchurch began in 1873, the very year of the death of missionary explorer Dr. David Livingstone, the best friend Africa ever had, the man who did more than anyone else to expose and end the slave trade in Central and East Africa. The cathedral was completed and consecrated in 1903. Inside the church is a cross made from the wood of the tree under which David Livingstone's heart was buried in Chitambo in northern Zambia. This is just replete with symbolism. Near this church, there's a striking monument which has been constructed above the 15 underground cells where the slaves in transit were incarcerated until their sale to their Arab masters. The monument consists of 5 stone figures in a pit, representing the captured slaves who appear to be rising out of the earth. The shackles around their necks, the chains between them testify to their plight. They look tired and sad, but they look strong. Would this not have been a good photo op? Not if you're pro-Muslim, it wouldn't. And if you're anti-Christian. But otherwise, you would have thought this cathedral would have been a good place to have visited. So, some Africans are asking why Barack Obama, an African-American president, continues to be so supportive of radical Muslim regimes who are still involved in slavery today. Why is he so silent about the largest and the longest slave trade in history? One that hasn't yet come to an end. Now, the comparisons and the contrast between Gori Island and Zanzibar Island are striking. While the European involvement in the transatlantic slave trade to the Americas lasted over three centuries, the Arab involvement in the slave trade has lasted 14 centuries. And in some parts of the Muslim world, it's still continuing today. While two out of three slaves shipped across the Atlantic were men, the proportions were reversed in the Islamic slave trade in East Africa, in the Indian Ocean, and across the Sahara. Two women for every man were enslaved by the Muslims. While the mortality rate for slaves being transported across the Atlantic was as high as 10% may die before reaching the Americas, the percentage of slaves dying in transit in the Trans-Sahara East African slave trade was between 80 and 90%. So it's reversed. Most died. 90% could die on some of the slave caravans. In fact, I document in my book how sometimes all of the slaves died. The entire 100% died before they reached slave market on some occasions. But the average was 80 to 90% mortality rate. While almost all of the slaves shipped across the Atlantic were for agricultural work in the fields, often the cotton fields of the south, many of the slaves destined for the Muslim Middle East were for sexual exploitation as concubines in harems and for military service. While many children were born to the slaves in the Americas, and millions of their descendants are citizens in Brazil, Jamaica, Haiti, and the USA to this day, very few of the slaves that end up in the Muslim Middle East survive. While most of the slaves who went to the Americas could marry and have families, most of the male slaves destined for the Middle East slave bazaars were castrated. Most of the children born to the women were killed at birth. They had sometimes 8, 9, 12, 18,000 eunuchs working in a single palace of a khalifa. And the children, either by drowning or having their throats slit, were killed to maintain Arab numerical superiority. And that's why you won't get descendants of the slaves in the Muslim Middle East today, because they said it's cheaper to get new slaves than to have our slaves distracted with the unproductive exercise of raising the next generation. Now, it's estimated that possibly as much as 11 million Africans were transported across the Atlantic in the 300 years of the European involvement in slave trade. But notice that 95% of these went to South and Central America, to Portuguese, to Spanish, and to French possessions, like Brazil, Haiti, and so on. Less than 5% of the slaves went to North America. In fact, 4.4% went to North America. You'd never know that from the average films and textbooks today. However, at least 28 million Africans were enslaved by the Muslims. As at least 80% of those captured by the Muslim slave raiders were calculated to have died before reaching the slave markets, it's believed that the death toll from the 14 centuries of Muslim slave raids into Africa could be well over 112 million. When added to the number of those sold in the slave markets, the total number of African victims of the Trans-Sahara and East African slave trade could be significantly higher than 140 million people. And I'm convinced it was more, but I'm taking the lowest stats possible here. While Christian reformers spearheaded the anti-slavery abolitionist movements, with Great Britain mobilizing the Royal Navy throughout the 19th century to intercept slave ships, to set captives free, there was no comparable opposition to slavery within the Muslim world. Name a Muslim abolitionist. I mean, we can name Christian abolitionists, there's no shortage. Wilberforce. William Wilberforce, David Livingstone, Dr. Jerry Kirk. You can think of General Charles Gordon and Sudan and many others, but honestly, you're going to be really stuck to get a Muslim to be able to name one Muslim abolitionist. We assisted in the production of this book, The Royal Navy versus the Slave Traders, a century of abolition at sea. The Royal Navy did more than any other institution in the history of the world of setting captives free. One of the most extraordinary, unselfish applications of national policy. I don't think in the history of the world any military force has been dedicated to such an altruistic motive. Something that had no benefit to the British government at all, but setting captives free, it was the evangelical impulse.
So the problem with the Muslim slave trade is they take them over the desert or in the Indian Ocean, and that's not where the Royal Navy really functions. They function more in the Atlantic.
Yes, well, it's that's part of it, but the main thing is William Wilberforce and his friends knew about the slave trade to the Americas. They were oblivious to the slave trade going on within Africa and across the Indian Ocean. And it was David Livingston who alerted them to that. And that was a whole new generation of warfare. So then the Royal Navy was mobilized in the Indian Ocean, but only after David Livingston drew their attention to it. So what William Wilberforce did in the previous generation, David Livingston extended. And that's why the British started to get involved in, like, sending Sir Samuel Baker down the Nile, and then General Charles Gordon to stop the slave trade across the Sahara, and sending Dr. Jerry Kirk to Zanzibar, and mobilizing the Royal Navy to set free slaves as they were coming from Bagamoyo in Tanzania across to Tanzania, and they'd often intercept them even before they got to Zanzibar and from Zanzibar. So the Royal Navy got involved later, but it was only David Livingston that made that known.
So that was the other slave trade. That's been behind the invasion of India and Jerusalem
Are you talking about for the colonials?
Yes.
There's a lot of what people call colonialism that was not colonialism but protectorates. For example, the British never colonized Sudan, just for example. People who say that just demonstrates some ignorance. The Egyptians colonized Sudan. When the British built the Suez Canal, and then when the Egyptian government tried to nationalize, the British went and took Egypt, and then they suddenly were responsible for Sudan, where the Egyptians had been doing slave raids and ivory poaching. They then sent General Charles Gordon into Sudan to set the captives free and to end the slave trade in Sudan. And Sudan became a British protectorate later. But they never colonized it. In fact, they never took a cent out of Sudan. They only put money in. And some places asked for the British to come in, like Lawsiland, what today is Western Zambia, specifically to protect them and to end the slave trade, and Swaziland, Botswana. There's a lot of places. Malawi was also British protectorate. It wasn't meant to be a colony. And so there were places that were colonies. Northern Rhodesia
India was
a colony. India was a colony.
Israel wasn't a colony. Israel,
I think, became a British protectorate after the First World War. They wanted to take it because the Ottoman Empire had crumbled. It was a protectorate, and the goal was to give it independence. It wasn't meant to be a colony. Now, the British always had a clarity in their mind between this is a colony where we encourage settlers, and this is a protectorate. We don't encourage settlers. We're just going to protect them from slave trade or from other countries that might exploit and give them independence as soon as we can. So Sudan is one nose. It was meant to be a protectorate always, and in fact, I think it always was. Still, while Britain outlawed the slave trade in 1807, it's a long time ago, and the eight main powers of Europe outlawed the slave trade at the Congress of Vienna in 1815. Now, there's one notable exception. One country in Europe did not sign the anti-slavery document of the Council of Vienna in 1815. That was Portugal. And that's why David Livingston had no end of trouble with Portuguese and Portuguese East and West Africa, because they still did slave trade. They were the one European power that still played the fool with slavery. And in fact, you will get the understanding of that in even the film The Mission. It's got how the Portuguese are wanting to come and take that mission station, because the Spanish suddenly said, oh, Portugal can have it, but Portugal still did the slave trade. And remember, those missionaries stood firm at the mission while their people were basically wiped out. And that's based on a historic case. So all of Europe, that means Germany, Russia, Austria, France, England, of course, Sweden, they all said the slave trade is outlawed from 1815. That's almost 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. And yet, Saudi Arabia and Yemen only outlawed the slave trade in 1962. That's in my lifetime. I was born in 1960. So in my lifetime, Saudi Arabia and Yemen still had the slave trade. Now, people frequently talk about Britain and America's involved in slave trade, which is disgraceful. But it ended a long time ago. But Saudi Arabia, they officially only ended in 1962, and Mauritania only in 1980. And we know that they're still doing it now anyway. Malcolm X, notice the Islamic crescent and so on. Malcolm X, one of the most famous American black converts to Islam, noted during his pilgrimage, his Hajj to Mecca in 1968, he saw black slaves being sold in Mecca in 1968, which is 6 years after they had officially abolished the slave trade. So, we know that Saudi, I've got evidence from a lot of different people. Sudanese slaves are still ending up in Sudan. We have every reason to believe slavery has not ended in Saudi Arabia. This is just for foreign consumption. But there's a Muslim convert.
Have you seen the movie Taken?
Yes.
By Luc Besson.
Now that's exactly what we're talking about with human trafficking. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And again, what I was interested about was that the slave dealers, you see it more in Taken 2, are Muslims from Albania. But the ones they're selling it to are Muslims from the Middle East.
Ah.
Which is also actually accurate. I mean, that's in fact typical. Most of the slaves end up in the Muslim Middle East. The ongoing slave trade in Mauritania is well documented. The slave trade in Sudan and other parts of the Muslim world, well documented. We'll show you a film this afternoon where you actually see Baroness Caroline Cox of the British House of Lords going into Sudan, into a slave market and buying slaves. And from the cameras, to prove it can be done. Of course she sets them free, but she's documenting slavery is still taking place today, and you cannot question. There's been a lot of others, different journalists and key people, but this was a House of Lords representative who went into Sudan to prove the point. Slavery still exists in Sudan today. But apparently, all these inconvenient facts did not merit United States President Barack Hussein Obama's attention. He turned a blind eye. And rather than using his visit to Africa as an opportunity to draw attention to the ongoing slave trade or the persecution of Christians in North Africa, such as Northern Nigeria and Sudan and Egypt, he was satisfied with sermonizing about the need to be vigilant in defense of human rights of what ended 200 years ago. But he remained shockingly silent on the hideous abuse of human rights taking place right now with countries whom America has most favored nation status with. Those who want to know the rest of the story, which apparently Obama and much of the mass media and Hollywood want to ignore, that's why we produce books like Faith on the Fire, Sudan, Slavery and Terrorism, and the film Sudan, Land and Holocaust, which you'll see later today. Slavery, Terrorism and Islam is a fascinating, well-illustrated, thoroughly documented response to the relentless anti-Christian propaganda being generated by Muslim and Marxist groups and by Hollywood filmmakers who try to always victimize the Muslims and villainize the Christians. Karl Marx said, "The first battlefield is a rewriting of history. The better we know our history, the less we'll be ambushed by some Muslims or Marxists who will try to have us to apologize for the great things Christians have done in the past." Slavery, Terrorism, Islam, the historical roots and contemporary threats, it's already gone through 3 editions, actually it's 4 editions now, and 5 printings. 300 pages, 200 pictures, it's now 3 times the size of the first edition, and that earned me a death threat fatwa for Muslim radicals, to such an extent that the police in South Africa wanted me to go into witness protection program, change my name, go underground. I said, I can't do it, I'm a public figure, I've got a mission, I can't just abandon my ministry. And so they gave all kinds of advice and instructions on how to improve our security, and I had to bomb-proof my windows and my vehicle windows and home windows and put up cameras and lights and motion sensors and all sorts of other things like that. And they started giving us 24-hour patrols, and it's just extraordinary that Muslims, and they called the people involved. In fact, they said, these are real players. These are people who participated in the 7/7 bombings in London. I said, this is not just some idle threat from some Muslim wannabe. These are real terrorists who actually kill people. And they said, and that was for writing a history book. Now you can also access this PowerPoint, Slavery, What You've Never Been Told, as a PowerPoint. I've put over 80 of our PowerPoints on our website. You get onto Frontline Fellowship website, and we've got on SlideShare a whole bunch of them, plus many audio lectures such as this on sermonaudio.com. If you are on social media like Facebook, are we regularly putting updates on Facebook on under Frontline Fellowship, pictures of the persecuted church? We sometimes will have the pictures the day or the day after a church was burned in Egypt or bombed in northern Nigeria or a village bombed in Nib Mountains. We've now got contact with folks that through smartphones and satellite uploadings, we're actually able to sometimes within 24 hours have the picture and the report on. So if you want to keep up to date, give me your email address and check out and like and link with Frontline Fellowship. I also put some of the heaviest anti-Islamic propaganda that they throw out there under the Reformation 500 Facebook page. Reformation 500 just happens to have a lot of the even more radical things that I wouldn't even put under Frontline Fellowship, because we're a mission against Islam. We put under Reformation 500. That's all on Facebook. We've got a Muslim Evangelist Workshop MP3 with 20 of the lectures, and we helped to produce Islam Rising DVD, and you'll see the first of that series this afternoon too. It's incredible. Ex-Muslim terrorists, converts from Islam, giving you the facts from behind the scenes. I think it's the best documentary. This is designed to show at church midweek services, like one each week, 4 weeks, or Sunday evenings, whichever works in your church, in order to alert people to the threat and the danger of Islam. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. But instead of speaking out against the ongoing Islamic slave trade in Africa, President Obama seemed to have given the highest priority to promoting his radical pro-abortion, pro-homosexual agenda. He talks about gay rights, but gays have always had the same rights as anyone else. They've got the same right to property, to life, to vote. What human rights are they denied? What they are after is privileges for perverts. Because, look, marriage is a sacrament of the church. No government has the right to tell us what a marriage is. God has said marriage is between one man, one woman for life. How can a government come and tell the church what a marriage should be? And you know what's going to come next? Persecution of churches that teach against it, or a minister who refuses to do a homosexual marriage, or a chaplain in the army who refuses to do homosexual marriage. It's already happening. In American military, chaplains are being disciplined for refusing to do a homosexual marriage, which of course is no marriage at all. Freedom of conscience has been crushed, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of association. There have been caterers prosecuted now in some parts of the world, such as England, for refusing to cater for a homosexual wedding. And they're given contacts of other caterers willing. No, but we want your caterer. And they're just harassing them. There was a British bed and breakfast family. They're using their own home as a B&B. Next thing, some homosexual couple said they wanted to stay there in the same room, and said, sorry, we're Christian family, we can't do that. But you can go to this B&B and that one very close by who would happily accommodate you. No, but we want yours. So they got these people to court. It's obviously a test case. There's hundreds of B&Bs you can go to in London. They didn't have to select this poor Christian family. And they had to spend tens of thousands of pounds in legal defense on their right to open up their home to whoever they wish. Why should you be forced? But this is the thing. So, you know, if a person says homosexual rights or gay rights, think, oh, shame. Well, of course we want everyone to have equal rights, even if we don't agree with them. But this isn't about gay rights. This is about privileges for perverts. Now, there's some kinds of benefits you get for being married, or used to get, tax breaks, and maybe from the company you work for. But that's not because anyone cares who you're shacking up with. It's because a parent is producing children who are going to be the future producers and consumers and taxpayers in the future. And so we know a lot of sacrifice and expenses involved in being a parent, so there's some benefits. But that was not because, you know, it can't be because two fornicators or adulterers decide to get together. So why should it be because two homosexual perverts decide to get together? It's not about who shacks up together, it's about producing the next generation. And homosexuals cannot produce another generation. Simple. That's just the way it is. Now, what they're trying to do with getting all kinds of tax breaks and privileges at the workplace for, say, this is my homosexual lover, so you've got to give them the goal is, first of all, to eradicate any kind of benefits for any marriage. And then ultimately to destroy that whole idea of marriage. In the short term, they get a financial benefit. But in the long term, everyone will lose any benefits because it'll be pointless. It's not about who's living with who. It's about who's raising children. But, of course, they're obscuring the whole point. And Obama, his own cheerleaders, such as Newsweek, call him the first gay president.
Sorry, what? It's really contrasting. Do you think he's just playing the liberals versus with being gay and with the agenda in his own country versus Muslim?
I don't know if he is a homosexual.
No. I'm not.
No, he might be. But he is a homosexualist.
Yes.
You know the difference. A homosexual is one who practices, but a homosexual might mind his own business. But a homosexualist may be one who's a homosexual or not, who promotes their agenda. So you could say Bill Clinton was a homosexualist, even though he, I think, pretty definitely wasn't a homosexual, but he promoted their agenda. Now this man definitely is promoting their agenda heavily in the military. For example, how can you operate in the army with homosexuals? You just think of the army, shared showers, bungalows. How is this going to work? Now, the US military has had, I've got to get the stats right, I think it is the chief of the military in America is before Congress, because last year they had 32,000 sexual assaults reported. Reported! Now, I haven't seen a breakdown, but I bet a lot of it's homosexual abuse, but also, of course, America's foolish enough to put men and women into combat and into the same training, and which isn't very intelligent just to start with. But now, homosexuals can be in the military, which means you're going to have even more sexual abuse cases. As it happens, I didn't know the existence of homosexuals until I was accosted by one in the military. Now I was in the army, and I get one of these guys climbing all over me while I'm I was trying to sleep. Next thing, I took my metal fork from these metal eating pans and I wrapped it over his head. Had a nice big dent in it. And actually, first I sprayed my deodorant in his eyes and then bashed it over his head. Now, he didn't report it. How could he? I didn't report it. But today, I'd probably end up in jail for a hate crime.
Yeah.
For having, you know, hurt his feelings or something like that. So, because, you see, now that you've got homosexuals as a protected species, they can try and abuse or rape you, grope and all that, and if you report it, you might find yourself up for a hate crime. So you see how it's moved, that now the perverts and the predators have privileges, they've got benefits, legal protection that you don't have. And so we're more likely to be under attack. They said that most boys who are sexually abused never reported. Never reported. And so, you can imagine, the homosexuals are preying mostly on younger boys. Most of this is not going to be reported. But the American Army's got 32,000 sexual abuse cases on record for last year. What is going on in the US military? It's obviously a mess.
But it's a characteristic of gay sexual distortion.
Yes, they're not exactly into self-control.
No, they aren't. But okay, sorry. Let me just rephrase your. So, he's liberal. He's very much left-wing, and in his own country, he's obviously supporting pro-choice and gay. But then on the other side, he's got this Muslim game to play.
Yes.
So it's contrasting.
Those are conflicts. It is. But what does it have in common? Both anti-Christian. I wonder if these people aren't more anti-Christian than they are pro their own cause. These are sticks with which to beat the church. Pro-family advocates are complaining about the arrogant, bullying manner and insensitivity of the US State Department against pro-life and pro-family administrations in Africa. And the American people are outraged and shocked over how they can now start to have judicial bullying, where they're now telling them, this is what a marriage is. Now, wait a minute, the Bible says it's an abomination. The government has no business telling us what a marriage is. They can't even protect us from crime. And they're trying to define marriage now? Well, the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, and deputy president William Ruto accused Obama of being a bully and slammed his remarks when he said this country, the nation of Kenya, is a God-fearing nation. Homosexuality is illegal in Kenya, and many leaders in Africa are saying the same, like Uganda and Malawi. An Anglican bishop in Kenya put it very well. People who have ruined their own country should not presume to come here and lecture us on the way to go forward. I thought that was well said. In April, U.S. Agency for International Aid, that's USAID, embarked on one of the most shocking abuses of U.S. taxpayer dollars. The U.S. government announced that they'll be spending $11 million to train homosexual activists in other countries. The Washington Blade, which is D.C.'s main gay newspaper, praised the Obama administration for creating an army of international lobbyists for same-sex marriage and anti-discriminatory laws and homosexual rights throughout the world. And where they're targeting? The 54 countries in Africa that oppose homosexuality. Their first phase of their program is based on developing countries, code for Africa. Here's a map. These are the countries that allow homosexual marriage in the world. There's only one country in the continent of Africa that allows homosexual marriage, and we're in it.
Wow.
Sad to say. This used to be one of the most conservative countries in the world, and now it's the guinea pig for the New World Order. Because we've got one of the youngest constitutions in the world, written by foreigners. All written by the UN and others. This is not a South African, this isn't an African constitution. It isn't African to abort your babies. It isn't African to support homosexuality and pornography. Those things are foreign. This has got foreign fingerprints, and this just shows foreign experience. But imagine that. The bulk of the world is against homosexual marriages, but now the United States is coming along promoting a new army of evangelists to promote this new gospel of homosexuality. And this is the new agenda. So the American president spent $100 million of America's taxpayers' money, of course, to come to Africa, and his main message was homosexuality, lesbian, bisexual, gay, transsexual, transgender, and all that kind of nonsense.
It seems like, sorry if I'm just interrupting, one of the American guys here said, it seems like a next step is also going to be legalization of, I can have feelings for younger minor.
Oh, people. Pedophilia. Yeah.
And marriage in that context. And
I believe so. I believe that it opens the door to everything.
Yes.
If you can redefine marriage from what it's meant,
yes,
since the dawn of time,
yes,
then
how can it not
the
be natural for me to have feelings? I mean, if it's toward a man, it's,
yeah,
not toward,
well, they've already denied that there's a God,
mm-hmm,
and an absolute right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Many in Africa have described Obama's presidency as a bitter disappointment, and his Nobel Peace Prize of 2009 as the most cynical Orwellian meaningless gesture. Speaking about George Orwell, 1984, Newspeak, thought crimes. Is now you've got thought crimes and you speak just like they speak about in the 1984 so-called futuristic book. Steve Friedman, the director of Rhodes University and Johannesburg University, declared, I don't think that it is unkind to say that Obama has done absolutely nothing for Africa. In some respects, George W. Bush did more for Africa than Barack Obama. I cannot remember an American administration who's shown less interest in Africa than this one.
And he's a black man.
And I think that's true. I think he's shown the least interest. In fact, do you know that George Bush not only has done a lot of good for Africa, but recently friends of ours, good family friends, who missionaries in Kabwe, they were told there's an American family that's wanting to come out and do some work here. Is anyone willing to host them, look after them, and give them some practical work to do that they'd like to just help out missions? And our folks, there's no indication it would be. George Bush and his wife Laura Bush turned up, and they lived and worked, hard worked, among orphanage and school and did a whole lot of practice things. No fanfare. Did you see any pictures of it?
No.
I've yet to see pictures of it. The only picture I've seen is on Facebook from my friends. I haven't seen anything in the media. But my friends are up there in cupboard. And that's George Bush. In fact, I know from personal friends in America how George Bush, when he was president, he was the main guest speaker at a certain event. And they lost touch of where he was. And he was meant to speak, and they couldn't find him. And they're rushing around. The Secret Service couldn't find him. And they found him at one of the tables, sharing the gospel passionately. And he's leading this young man to the Lord. And he had lost track of time, too. And he'd gotten so wrapped up in this conversation. Now, this man who I know, he's a general in the U.S. military, in the Air Force. And he said, George Bush is like that. He actually gets so involved in people. And but the Secret Service lost track of where he was, which was very, very bad.
Why they always making fun of him?
George Bush is not the person that they depict in the media. Yeah. He's in fact a very sincere Christian. Now, for example, you might have heard of Heather Mercer. Heather Mercer and Donna Curry, they were two American missionaries who were locked up in Afghanistan. And they were sentenced to death in 2001 for showing the Jesus form on a laptop. And they were sentenced to death by the Taliban. They were going to be killed. And then 9/11 happened. America sent in the special forces and they were rescued. So these are the two American missionaries who were rescued from the Taliban just short of being executed. They were sentenced to death for showing the Jesus form to four Muslims separately on a laptop. Well, Heather Mercer came, visited our mission and shared our devotions, and we had a meal with her. And she said, the first person she spoke to, she got on the plane. She's on the helicopter taking out SEAL team leader, handed her the sat phone, George Bush on the phone, wanting to hear her well. First person she saw when she landed back in America, George Bush. He took her around the White House and gave a personal guide to her. She says, it was very hard to think of him as the president. He just came across as a brother in Christ. Now that's a missionary who I know is a no-nonsense missionary. She spent her life working amongst Muslims, and Heather Mercer is a no-nonsense missionary. But everyone, I haven't personally met George Bush, but everyone I know who has says, the man's intelligent, he's a Harvard graduate, he's a jet fighter pilot, he's not a fool, but they make him out in the media to be an absolute idiot, but he's a real Christian. And by the way, one of the very first official acts of George Bush after being elected President of America was to defund Planned Parenthood's abortions overseas. America put hundreds of millions of dollars every year because of Clinton to supporting Planned Parenthood's killing of babies around the world.
Mm.
Population control. He defunded it. First week in office. The very first act of President Barack Obama in the White House was to refund Planned Parenthood and to let the hundreds of millions of US dollars flow to kill babies in Africa. So because of Barack Obama's pro-abortion policies, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions by now, of black babies have been killed in Africa through abortion with US taxpayers' money.
Yes.
George Bush saved lives, Barack Obama took lives through abortion. That's straightforward, and yet how many Christians are anti-Bush and pro-Obama? Does that make sense? Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, and so bring wrath on yourself from the Lord? By the way, this poster, our mission, one of our missionaries actually painted this banner. It's all oil painting on canvas. And this scripture banner was taken to Parliament at the opening of Parliament back in the days of Thabo Mbeki. And we know that Thabo Mbeki saw it, because our people right by the gate, and he went straight past on the way in. And minutes after Thabo Mbeki had driven into Parliament, a team of police in full battle gear came charging out, confiscated this banner, took it into the grounds and burned it. So we know Thabo Mbeki saw this banner. What's so offensive about saying, this day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you, that I've set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life so that you and your children may live. That's from Deuteronomy 30. Is that such a bad message that he had to have it confiscated and burned? So, we know who loved the wicked. So, this is a book that I wrote, which caused so much grief and gave so much attacks. In fact, do you know, even the first edition was so in demand, it went to hundreds of dollars a copy on Amazon.com. It went to $4,000 for a single copy. We thought, goodness me, I bought a second edition and I didn't want to reprint, and then bought a third edition, three times size, and even now, I looked on eBay recently, they're still selling these for over $100, even the fourth edition ones each, and we only sell them for $15, I think it is. So, you know, incredible that it's, we can never print enough. These are always in demand. So the Muslims banning these things don't particularly work.
Perhaps they are buying it.
Well, I suppose in one sense it could be the bad guys wanting to get rid of them. So, slavery, what have you never been told? Our Lord Jesus said, you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. While much has been written about the transatlantic slave trade, how much has been written about the Islamic slave trade across Sahara, the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean? This is what you normally see. What you don't normally see is that there was a lot of slavery going on throughout Africa, to the Ottoman Empire, to Morocco, to the Arab world, and even to the Indian Ocean territories. And it's lasted 14 centuries and it's still going on. The contrast between the American and the Arab slave trade is huge. And as I pointed out in the last section of this, the mortality rates are reversed. 10% mortality rate across the Atlantic, 90% mortality rate across the Sahara. And the purposes of it contrasted. You think of how many prominent leaders in America have come, such as Condoleezza Rice and the American Secretary of State, General Powell. They were descendants of slaves. And how they have flourished, but you can't point to the Muslim world and show any descendants of African slaves who went there who have flourished. You had families amongst the slaves that went to the Americas, but you did not have that in the Middle East. They had a very different type of slave trade. And a lot of what I have documented about the slave trade in the Muslim Middle East comes from their own books. And one of them is Islam's Black Slaves. And this is not from someone who's pro-Christian at all. There's no comparable opposition to slavery within the Muslim world. And you think that nearly 100 years after Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in America, and 130 years after all slaves within the British Empire had been set free, Saudi Arabia grudgingly abolished slavery in 1962 and Mauritania in 1980. And that's only after massive international pressure. It wasn't from internal opposition at all. Now, do you know Ethiopia's slavery until 1942? What happened in 1942? The Springbok Legion liberated Abyssinia. The South African Army liberated Abyssinia, what today is Ethiopia, from the Italians. Now, if you go to the history books today, most of it say the British Army liberated them. Not true, it was the South African Army. The South African Army went up and liberated Abyssinia, what today is Ethiopia, marching into Abyssinia. These were South African troops. Now, isn't that interesting? That's when the slave trade was ended in Abyssinia, in Ethiopia, because the South African Army insisted on being outlawed before they withdrew and handed back to the people. Now, that's not politically correct or interesting piece of information. That kind of upsets the whole apple cart. South Africans are meant to be oppressors, not liberators. Saudi Arabia, they say 1962. Peru abolished the slave trade in 1968. India abolished slavery only in 1976. And in fact, it's still continuing with the caste system. Mauritania, 1980, but they're still doing it to the day. Before the coming of Christ, heathen nations despised manual work and they consigned manual work to slaves. When Christ was born, half of the Roman Empire were slaves. Three quarters of the population of Athens were slaves. Slavery was indigenous to Africa and to Arab countries long before it made its way to Europe. Slavery was widely practiced by all the tribes of the American Indians long before Christopher Columbus set foot on the shores of the New World. Many people suggest that the people in India, of the Indians in America, lived some kind of democratic tranquility and intertribal harmony, and the colonists ruined it. Not so. What's seldom remembered is that many black Americans in the 19th century owned slaves. For example, in the United States Census of 1830, in the one town of Charleston, South Carolina, 407 black Americans owned slaves themselves. And most people don't know about the Christian roots of liberty. Our Lord Jesus Christ revolutionized labor by taking up the axe, the saw, the hammer, and the plane. Our Lord endued labor with a new dignity. Christianity undercut slavery by giving dignity to work. By reforming work, Christianity transformed the entire social order. Our Lord Jesus Christ began his ministry in Nazareth with these words: "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and release to the oppressed." When the Apostle Paul wrote to Philemon concerning his escaped slave, he urged him to welcome back Onesimus, no longer as a slave, but as a dear brother, as a man and as a brother in the Lord. And because of these and many other scriptural commands to love our neighbor, to be a good Samaritan, and to do for others what we want them to do for us, Christians like William Wilberforce and John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, and William Carey, the father of modern missions to India, and David Livingstone, and Lord Shaftesbury, and General Charles Gordon worked tirelessly to end the slave trade, to stop child labor, to set the captives free. That's our Christian legacy. From the very beginning of the Christian church, Christians freed slaves. During the second and third centuries, many tens of thousands of slaves were freed by people who were converted to Christ. Saint Melina, said to have emancipated 8,000 slaves. Saint Ovidus freed 5,000. Promotius, 1,400 slaves set free. Hermas, 1,200. Many of the Christian clergy at Hippo under Saint Augustine freed their slaves as an act of piety. You'd be converted, you'd set your slaves free. It's just one of those things that showed you were converted. By 315 AD, the Emperor Constantine, just 2 years after he issued the Edict of Milan, legalizing Christianity, imposed the death penalty on those who sold children, or stole children, to sell them as slaves. By the way, I don't know if you know who this picture's of. This is a picture of Britons. These are the Angles, or the Britons, in a Roman slave market. And one of the bishops said, "Let us make angels of these Angles." The Emperor Justinian abolished all laws that prevented the freeing of slaves, and Saint Augustine in the 4th century saw slavery as a product of sin and contrary to the divine plan of God. In his book, The City of God, he said, "Slavery is the antithesis of Christianity. Christianity brings liberty. Christians are not slaves, and Christians will not own slaves, as Christians are always free slaves." That is Christianity. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. Saint Chrysostom, the Golden Mouth, one of the greatest preachers of the 4th century, who was the pastor of Saint Sophie, the greatest church in the world at that time, he taught that when Christ came, he annulled slavery. Because right at the beginning, Luke 4, he proclaimed the year of Jubilee to set the captives free. He proclaimed, "In Christ Jesus there is no slave, therefore it is not necessary to have a slave. Buy them, and after you've taught them some skill by which they can maintain themselves, set them free." For centuries throughout the Middle Ages, bishops and church councils recommended the redemption of Christian slaves and of all captive slaves, and for 5 centuries the Trinitarian monks redeemed Christian slaves from the Turks, or the Moors, the Muslims, who had them in slavery. So they would save up and buy money and buy them with money back so they could set them free. In 1102 AD in London, the London Church Council outlawed slavery and the slave trade straight. By the 12th century, slaves in Europe were so rare, and by the 14th century, slavery was almost extinct on the continent of Europe. But then what happened? The Islamic slave trade. With the birth of Islam came a rebirth of the slave trade. As Ronald Segal, who's an enemy of Christianity, who is an admirer of Islam, But he's written in Islam's Black Slaves, which I've very carefully studied. He documents when Islam conquered the Persian Sassanid Empire and much of the Byzantine Empire, including Syria and Egypt, in the 7th century, they acquired immense quantities of gold. They stripped all the churches and monasteries, either directly or by taxes, payable in gold, imposed on the clergy. So they imposed taxes on gold on the clergy. They looted gold from tombs like the pyramids. The state encouraged the tombs, encouraged the search, and the sanctioned the seizure in return for a fifth of the fines. And you know, many people speak about the grave robbers who have stripped the tombs of Egypt's pyramids. Not just the Muslims. The Egyptians never did that. And they just have these anonymous grave robbers. Well, it weren't anonymous. It was a systematic attempt. When the Muslims took over the place, they struck everything, including the tombs. Segal notes, female slaves were acquired in considerable numbers for musicians, singers, dancers. Many more were bought for domestic workers. Many were in demand as concubines. The harems of rulers could be enormous. The harem of Abdul Rahman III in the 10th century in Cordoba, Cordoba, by the way, is what they called Spain, contained over 6,000 concubines. The one in the Fatimid Palace in Cairo had twice as many. Islam's Black Slaves reveals the castration of black slaves was common. All males. The Khalifa in Baghdad at the beginning of the 10th century had 7,000 black eunuchs, 4,000 white eunuchs in his palace. It's noted that there was widespread homosexual relations as well. Islam's Black Slaves noted that Islam's teachers throughout the centuries consistently defended slavery, for there must be slaves and masters. Just in the 19th century, for which we have most accurate records, 1.2 million slaves brought across the Sahara into the Middle East, 450,000 down the Red Sea, 442,000 from East African coastal ports. That is a total of 2 million black slaves just in the 1800s alone. At least 8 million more were calculated to have died before reaching the Muslim slave markets. So that made 10 million just in the 1800s. In Islam's Black Slaves, Segal writes, in the 1570s, a Frenchman visiting Egypt found many thousands of blacks on sale in Cairo on market days. In 1665, Father Antonius Gonzalez, a Spanish-Belgian traveler, reported 800 to 1,000 slaves on sale in a Cairo market on a single day. In 1796, a British traveller reported a caravan of 5,000 slaves departing from Darfur. Darfur is in the news again, but it's always been a slave trafficking area. In 1838, it was estimated that 10,000 to 12,000 slaves are arriving in Cairo every year. Just in the Arabic plantations off the east coast of Africa on the islands of Zanzibar and Temba, there are 769,000 black slaves. In the 19th century, the East African black slave trade included 347 slaves shipped to Arabia, Persia, and India, 95,000 slaves shipped to the Arab plantations in the Mascarene Islands. One caravan with 3,000 proceeding from the coast in East Africa lost two-thirds of their number from starvation, disease, and murder. In the Nubian desert, one slave captain of 2,000 slaves literally vanished as every slave died. Here's an eyewitness account from a British captain of the Royal Navy, 1818. He reported that the Al-Makani in Tripoli waged war on all its defenseless neighbors, every year carrying off 4,000 to 5,000 slaves, a pitiful spectacle. These poor oppressed beings were, many of them, so exhausted as to be scarcely able to walk. Their legs and their feet were much smelled, and by their enormous size formed a striking contrast with their emaciated bodies. They were all borne down with loads of firewood, and even the poor little children, worn to skeletons by fatigue and hardships, were obliged to bear their burden, while many of the inhuman masters, with dreadful whip suspended from their waist. All the traders speak of slaves as farmers do of cattle. The defenseless state of the Negro kingdoms to the southward are temptations too strong to be resisted. A force is therefore annually sent to pillage those defenseless people, to carry them off as slaves, to burn their towns, to kill the aged and infants, destroy their crops, and inflict on them every possible misery. All slavery is for an unlimited time. None of the owners ever moved without their whips, which were in constant use. Drinking too much water, bringing too little wood, or falling asleep before the cooking was finished were considered nearly capital crimes. And it was in vain for these poor creatures to plead the excuse of being tired. Nothing could withhold the application of the whip. Records for Morocco, 1876, showed the market price for slaves varied from £10 to £30. Female slaves comprised the vast majority of sales, with attractive virgins fetching between £40 to £80. It was reported that a considerable majority of slaves crossing the Sahara were destined to become concubines in North Africa, the Middle East, and occasionally further afield. Now that some people know about, but what most people don't know about is the Christian slaves of Muslim masters. White slaves from Christian Spain, Central and Eastern Europe were also shipped in the Middle East and served in the palaces of the rulers and the establishments of the rich. He recorded that all Slavic eunuchs were castrated in that region and the operation was performed by Jewish merchants. Now the Slavs, remember, the people of Russia, Ukraine, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, those would be Slavs, Poles, for example. In fact, the name slave comes from Slav. That's the etymology of the word, because the Romans got their slaves mostly from the Slavic regions. So when people suggest that slaves were always black people, they don't understand. Slaves, even the name shows it was mostly white Europeans or the Slavs. Historian Robert Davis has written a book, Christian Slaves, Muslim Masters, White Slavery in the Mediterranean, the Barbary Coast, and Italy. He recorded that North African Muslim pirates abducted and enslaved well over a million Europeans between 1530 and 1780. These white Christians were seized in a series of raids which depopulated coastal towns from Sicily to Cornwall, which is in England. Thousands of white Christians in coastal areas were seized every year to work as galley slaves, rowing boats, laborers, concubines for Muslim slave masters in today what is Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya. Villages and towns on the coast of Italy, Spain, Portugal, France were the hardest hit. But the Muslim slave raiders also seized people as far afield as Britain, Ireland, and Iceland. They even captured 130 American seamen from ships they boarded in the Atlantic between 1785 and 1793. According to one report, 7,000 English people were abducted between 1622 and 1644. And by the way, what happened in 1644 to stop it? Oliver Cromwell and the parliamentary forces seized control of England, and they built up a much better navy, and Admiral Blake went out and he burned these slave ships all over the Mediterranean, and nobody dared mess with England after the Commonwealth, because Britain developed its first professional army and the first professional navy. So 1644 is a landmark year. That's kind of when raiding of England became out of bounds. But the corsairs often landed on unguarded beaches, often at night, to snatch the unwary. Almost all the inhabitants of the village of Baltimore in Ireland were captured in 1631, and there were raids in Devon and Cornwall. Many of these white Christian slaves were put to work in quarries, building sites, galleys. Almost everything important, every harbour and palace in the whole of North Africa was built by white slaves. And they endured malnutrition, disease, mistreatment at the hands of the Muslim slave masters. Many of them were used for public works like building harbours. Female slaves were sexually abused in palace harems. Others were held as hostages and bargained for ransom. The most unlucky ended up stuck and forgotten out in the desert in some sleepy town like Suez or in the Turkish Sultanate galleys, where some slaves rode for decades without even setting foot on shore. Professor Davis estimates up to 1.25 million Europeans were enslaved by Muslim slavers between 1500 and 1800. That's extraordinary that considering that less than 5% of all the transatlantic slaves end up in North America, the vast majority of films, books, and articles concerning the slave trade concentrate only on the American involvement in slave trade, the best example of which is Amistad. Amistad is actually an extraordinarily well-made film. And I must say, considering an unbelieving Jewish man, Steven Spielberg, produced it. It's got one of the best gospel presentations in any film I've seen, made by a non-Christian. Better than the gospel presentations of some Christian films, even. When the slave's given a illustrated Bible, and they're going through it, and you see with the subtitles, they're trying to, this man explains what he thinks is taking place in the pictures. And very powerful, very effective. I'm amazed that Steven Spielberg could let such a powerful Christian testimony come through. But the conclusion of the film is one of the most uplifting scenes I've seen in any film, as it shows the Royal Navy raiding the slave forts in West Africa and setting the captives free, which also is so accurate because that's what the British did. And while it's primarily showing you the foolishness and wickedness of Americans, it does show the courage and the anti-slavery zeal and crusade spirit of the Royal Navy, which is excellent.
Have you seen the movie The Four Feathers?
Unfortunately, yes.
It also defeats the Muslim slaves, doesn't it?
But The Four Feathers is ahistoric in many different ways. I've got a review on that film also on my website, because the only really religious person in the whole film is this black Nubian who's a Muslim. Now, I know the Nubians, and the Nubians are Christians. And he's fighting against the Muslims, but he's a Muslim. And he's buying Jamaica and all this. And all the British are without faith, except one coward who prays for courage, doesn't have it, runs around doing a battle and gets himself shot by his own side.
Yeah.
And he's the only Christian in the film, or so-called. And they have a whole lot of ahistoric, impossible garbage in it. Like, for example, you're either infantry or you're cavalry or you're camel corps. But in this film, the guys drift from cavalry to camel corps to infantry, backwards and forwards, which doesn't happen. It's like in Pearl Harbor, fighter pilots suddenly become bomber pilots.
Yeah.
Flying off, mind you, the Navy's decks, whereas the Navy had their own air force, by the way. The American Naval Air Corps didn't need fighter pilots to suddenly fly bombers. If you train as a fighter pilot, you're a fighter pilot. You're not going to be a bomber pilot. If you train as camel corps, you're camel corps. You're not going to suddenly be infantry or cavalry, and so on. But in The Four Feathers, they just move around. And then the big battle of Abu Klea is a British victory. In this form, it's a defeat. And Abu Klea was the entire camel corps, 400 British soldiers in the camel corps. There's not a camel to be seen. The camel corps is all infantry with a couple of cavalry, with cavalry officers instructing infantry what to do, which also doesn't happen, actually. And so they make a defeat out of a British victory, and then they have a British garrison that got wiped out, which didn't exist. No British garrison was wiped out in Sudan because no British garrison existed. There was no British garrison in Sudan. They were coming to rescue General Charles Gordon, and he had only Egyptian troops. There was no British troops with him. So every key ploy in the film is false. Okay, it shows a bit of Islamic involvement in slave trade, but when I wrote my critique on the film, The Four Feathers, I was told by Ted Baer, who runs Movie Guide, sadly, the scriptwriter for that film was an evangelical Christian. Why would an evangelical Christian depict Christians in such a negative light and have the main hero in many ways as a Muslim, Nubian, which is just almost impossible? And there's just so much in it that why can't Christians write proper scripts? Why do they? In fact, there's more gospel in Steven Spielberg's Amistad than there was in The Four Feathers, which apparently a Christian was a scriptwriter of. So there's some shocking cowardice, or maybe just ignorance, on the sides of many Christians today. We need Christian missionaries in Hollywood and in business in every area. Still, Amistad, although it's done by non-Christian, I think it's got a lot of good Christian message in. But still, they need to make lots of films like this on the Arab slave trade and on the slaves who went to South and Central America. And insofar as it goes, this film's good. But I'm just concerned about the missing story that they never focus on the other side. as though slavery was a uniquely American aberration, but it wasn't. But think, the vastly greater involvement of Portugal and Spain and France seems to be largely ignored. And even more, the far greater and longer running Islamic slave trade in the Middle East has been so ignored as to make it one of history's best kept secrets. We tend to focus on what happened in North America because the United States would eventually fight a war in part over slavery, and because of the enormous vocal American opposition to slavery. But this is in sharp contrast to the indifference that Muslims and many Europeans have evidenced towards it. In fact, as the president of Benin pointed out some years ago, everyone in Africa is descended from those who are both victims of the slave trade and descended from slave traders themselves. It's a fact of history that, I'm going to say almost every tribe in Africa practiced slavery, but as far as we know, every tribe practiced. But just in case it's one we don't know about, I'll say almost every tribe in Africa practiced slavery. It was part of the criminal justice system. They didn't have prisons. The person who upset the chief for one reason or another became a slave. And they also enslaved neighboring tribes and they captured them. The Yao people of Malawi carried out slave raids on the Bemba and the Chichewa of Zambia. The Madagascans enslaved the Mozambicans. The Bemba enslaved the Bushmen. In fact, they still do. That's why the South African army had so many volunteers in the Bushmen. Thousands of Bushmen joined the South African army to get their revenge on their Bembas, who are now at Swapo, and because they'd been slaves for centuries. And I know many Bembas who... I know many Bushmen who'd been enslaved by Bembas who were in fact so harsh that we would have to try and protect the captured Swapo because if the Bushmen got hold of them, that would be the end of them. And the Matabele, amongst whom I grew up, enslaved the Shona people. And the Congolese people enslaved the Pygmies and still do. In Lawsiland, western Zambia, the paramount chief of the Barotse abolished slavery only in 1906. You can actually go to the Livingston Museum and see the document abolishing slavery in 1906. The legends of European slave raiders venturing into the jungles of Africa to capture free peoples are just that, legends. The embarrassing fact of history is the Europeans did not have to use any force to capture these slaves. The slaves were sold by the black owners. There was no need for the slave raiders to risk their lives or venture into the jungles of Africa. They simply purchased people from the African chiefs and from the Muslim slave raiders at the coast. Many chiefs found it more profitable to sell their enemies, their criminals and their debtors, than to kill or imprison them. Many were weaker neighboring tribes conquered for the express purpose of selling the people into slavery. The disgraceful fact is that there were three equally guilty partners in the crime of the transatlantic slave trade. There were pagan African chiefs, Muslim Arabs and Christian Europeans involved in this three-parted crime. Mostly African chiefs sold their own people or engaged in wars and slave raids against neighboring tribes to capture victims for this trade. Often professional Arab slave traders provided the victims. The Middle Passage transported slaves to the West Indies. So Europe sent a whole lot of manufactured goods to Africa to trade for slaves. Slaves went on the Middle Passage from Africa to the West Indies, and from there they got rum, molasses, sugar and so on, and that went back to England. And so that was, as they call it, the Middle Passage. Manufactured goods to Africa, slaves to the West Indies, and then raw materials, cotton, sugar, tobacco to Europe. The people in Europe saw goods being sold, goods coming in, and they were actually ignorant over what was in the middle. They might have heard about it, but they didn't see it. And this is the reality. These were the places involved in the slave trade, these ports. And the so-called Middle Passage mostly went, of course, to South and Central America, but a few went to the north of America. The average Englishman in the street was kept in the dark as to what was actually happening on the Middle Passage until 1785. Thomas Clarkson's landmark study, Slavery and the Commerce in Human Species, first published in Cambridge. And this led to William Wilberforce's War Against Slavery. Sunday the 28th of October, 1787, William Wilberforce wrote in his diary, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and a reformation of society. For the rest of his life, William Wilberforce dedicated his life as a member of Parliament to opposing the slave trade and working for the abolition of slavery throughout the British Empire. On the 22nd of February, 1807, 20 years after he first began his crusade, in the middle of Britain's war against France, Wilberforce and his team's labours were rewarded with victory. By an overwhelming 283 votes for to 16 against, the motion to abolish slave trade was carried in the House of Commons. The parliamentarians leapt to their feet with great cheers and gave Wilberforce the greatest and most emotional ovation ever seen in British history. William bent forward in his seat, his head in his hands, tears of gratitude streaming down his face, something very un-British. But that was his life's work. In 1809, the British government mobilized its navy to search suspected slave ships, even foreign vessels on the high seas. In 1810, the British Parliament declared slave trading a felony, punishable by 14 years hard labor. By 1814, the British representative at the Congress of Vienna insisted on the abolition of the slave trade being included in the international treaty, which most governments were hesitant to do, but after the victory at Waterloo, the treaty was signed by all the European powers, 9th June 1815. 1825, Britain passed a bill making slave trading punishable by death. Finally, just 3 days before William Wilberforce died, by an act of Parliament in 1833, the British abolished slavery itself, setting all 700,000 captives free in all British overseas possessions, most of them actually in Jamaica. Wilberforce's lifetime campaign of 59 years was now fully successful. Thank God that I've lived to witness the day in which England is willing to give £20 million for the abolition of slavery. Within 3 days he died rejoicing. And that's just one chapter in the greatest century of missions. The history of European morals suggests that the unwary, unostentatious and glorious crusade of England against slavery may probably be regarded as among the three or four perfectly virtuous pages composed in the history of nations. In other words, most of what most countries do is selfish. This is one of the few times in history that a government's actually done something unselfish. The abolition of slavery is one of the great turning points in history, and the long, vigorous crusade of the British Navy throughout the 19th century against the slave trade ranks as one of the most extraordinary, unselfish applications of national policy ever seen in the history of nations. And that is a Muslim slave ship being taken out. And here, Tripoli being bombed. And the Muslims being very reasonable once they're brought to under the guns. Where the spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. You can see they're burying the chain and the whip. And I've got the emancipation proclamation here. The Bible clearly marked. Livingston's travels also exposed a lot. Because as the British Navy was defeating the slave trade in the Atlantic, and the East African slave trade was increasing, it was the missionary explorer David Livingston whose graphic descriptions brought the ravages of the East African slave trade to light. His missionary travels and narrative of an expedition to the Zambezi exposed the horrors of the slave trade. Two of the women had been shot the day before for attempting to untie their thongs. One woman had her infant's brains knocked out because she could not carry a load and hit. A man was dispatched with an axe because he had broken down with fatigue. Those taken out of the country are but a very small section of the sufferers. We never realized the atrocious nature of the traffic until we saw it at the fountainhead. There, truly, Satan has her seat. Besides, he's actually captured. Thousands were killed and died of their wounds and famine, driven from the villages by the intervicting war waged for slaves, or by their own clansmen and neighbors, slain by the lust of gain, which is stimulated, be it remembered always, by the slave purchases of Cuba and elsewhere. That's just one of David Livingston's quotes. The British and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society reported that most slaves are captured in the Lake Nyasa region, Lake Malawi and Mozambique, in the Barrel Gazelle region of Sudan, and in areas of Ethiopia. The slaves are taken to East African markets like Zanzibar, Kilwa, and Kiliman. They're shipped to Turkey, India, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, Arog, Aron, to the islands of Pemba, Reunion, and Madagascar. The anti-slavery reporter estimated that the Muslim slave trade was exporting 63,000 slaves a year. Some estimates went as high as 500,000 slaves in a single year, which would change all the statistics if that was true. One researcher, Ralph Austin, calculated that between 1830 and 1861, imported slaves to the Persian Gulf averaged 3,400 per year. The same researcher noted an average of 8,855 slaves were retained on the East African coast as slaves of African slave masters. Very few authors dare describe the horrors involved in the trans-African slave trade. Kidnapping, castrating young boys to be sold as eunuchs, the living dead, in the homes of wealthy Arab landlords. Forced marching young men across endless miles of scorching sand in the Sahara to become slave concubines, most dying in transit. The Muslim slave trade dealt typically in castrated male slaves, eunuchs. Absolutely ghastly. The survival process was 1 in 10 to 1 in 30. But they fetched the highest price in the market. Islam's Black Slaves notes that the Quran stipulated that female slaves might lawfully be enjoyed, that's the word used, by their masters. Muhammad himself owned slaves, many of whom he captured in wars of conquest, and some of whom he purchased. The names of 40 slaves owned by Muhammad are recorded by Muslim chroniclers. Islamic Sharia law contains elaborate regulations for slavery. A slave had no right to be heard in court. Testimony was forbidden by slaves. Slaves had no right to property. Slaves could only marry with the permission of the master. They were considered to be chattel, movable property of the slave owner. Muslim slave owners were specifically entitled by Sharia law to sexually exploit their slaves, hiring them out as prostitutes even. This is what the Holy Quran says. One reason why very little has been written about the Arab involvement in the slave trade is that traditional Islamic culture still condones slavery. The Sharia, the codified Islamic law, which is based on the teachings and example of Muhammad, contains explicit instructions for slavery. One of the principles of Islam is to follow the example of Muhammad. So whatever Muhammad did, we must do. Whatever he forbade, we must forbid. Whatever he didn't forbid, we cannot forbid. So if Muhammad himself traded in slaves and owned slaves and accumulated multiple wives, even marrying a six-year-old and having concubines, slavery and the sexual exploitation of women is deeply ingrained in Islamic culture and tradition. Muslim nations have engaged in the slave trade for over 600 years before Europe became involved in the transatlantic slave trade. And by the way, which European countries got involved in the slave trade? Spain and Portugal, who had been oppressed and enslaved by the Muslims for hundreds of years. So they'd learned from their masters what to do. And so when they got free, Spain enforced a vengeance on Africa, because unfortunately they didn't tell the difference between a Muslim African and non-Muslim African, but their attitude was, we've been enslaved by the Africans for 8 centuries, we are now doing it to them. And the one who authorized Spain's involvement? Charles V. The same Charles V before Martin Luther made a stand, here I stand and can do no other, an enemy of the Reformation. Who authorized Britain's involvement in the slave trade? Charles I. The same Charles I that Oliver Cromwell opposed and who was tried by Parliament for treason and beheaded. So it's the enemies of the Reformation who led Europe's involvement into the slave trade. Oliver Cromwell abolished the slave trade from England. And after his death, Charles II brought the slave trade back. So it's an interesting story when you actually get into what's involved. But as you know, slavery is still going on today in Sudan, in Mauritania, in Saudi Arabia. And there's a lot of persistent reports of slaves still ending up in Saudi Arabia. Mehdi Nazir's testimony is one example of that. But although the Old Testament provided for slavery for criminals and insolvent debtors, kidnapping and enslaving law-abiding people always incurred the death penalty. Anyone who kidnaps another and sells him or still has him in his court must be put to death. Exodus 21:16. So people may say, well, you have slavery in the Bible. Yes. But slavery in the Bible was for the criminal justice system. A debtor or a criminal could be enslaved. to pay for his crime. But it was for a limited period until that was settled. And they had to be set free after 7 years anyway. And so the Old Testament did provide, but not kidnapping some poor innocent soul. It was a criminal justice. Instead of having a prison, you had indentured labor. Because the person wouldn't pay or couldn't pay restitution for property crime, he was compelled to be a slave until he had done his restitution. So while the Old Testament provides for slavery, it was only in the context of a criminal justice system, never to just enslave some poor innocent soul. That had the death penalty. The New Testament expressly forbids both the slave trade and slavery itself. Notice 1 Timothy 1. The law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers, for those who kill their fathers and mothers, for murderers, for adulterers, for perverts, for slave traders and liars and perjurers. Notice slave traders in the middle of the worst list you could have. Galatians 3:28 says, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, for you're all one in Christ Jesus. So plainly, Christ is annulled slavery. And we're commanded to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. How can you do that while enslaving your neighbor? You will know the truth will set you free. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Proclaim liberty throughout the land. Leviticus 25 verse 10. So this is the refrain throughout the scriptures. Liberty, freedom. Do not allow yourselves to be enslaved again. It is for freedom that Christ has set you free. Stand free then, as free men. Do not allow yourselves to be enslaved again. Galatians. So these are the principles. And so if somebody wants to bring up slavery, you Christians involved in slavery, we can point out, no, that's what paganism did. Christians have always spearheaded abolition of slavery. So, comments and questions? That's a long session, really. But it's a big subject. And any comments or questions?
Now, what's your goal? You said the only country that didn't sign the...
Yes, the abolition of the slave trade in 1815 was Portugal.
Yeah. And that's actually the war in Mozambique, how it started.
I guess so.
Because they don't want the Portuguese there anymore because they stole the people.
Well, the Portuguese were involved in the slave trade for a very long time. David Livingston clashed with the Portuguese a lot. And in fact, that embarrassed the royal family in Britain somewhat because there was some royal connection with the King of Portugal too. And they were trying to say, you know, your David Livingston's embarrassing things. But fortunately, Britain stood by him because he was doing the right thing. But he really embarrassed the Portuguese by his exposés and his reports. And that ultimately, David Livingston's writings forced Portugal in the end to just abolish the slave trade. So this article and others will be in our website. If you go under resources, there's articles on whole categories, including on slavery and Islam. It's got quite a lot of resource there. And this PowerPoint's also available under our PowerPoint as well, which is on the homepage.